Welcome to meeting number 3 of a 5-day online intensive with John Sherman, broadcast live from Ojai, California on June 26th, 2013.
Hello, everybody. I almost said good morning, but that probably isn't relevant to everybody here. It's good to see you. Good to be here with you. I thought that that it might be useful to take a couple of minutes in the beginning here to see if anybody has anything pertaining to yesterday's discussion of the fear of life that has occurred to them that they'd like to speak about or ask me about now. So if anybody here who was here yesterday and has any questions that weren't answered in the discussion of the fear of life or have confusion or something to add to it, let's take a couple minutes and do that now. If that's the case, raise your hand. Okay, then we'll move right along. What we have had scheduled to talk about today is the looking itself. And I was thinking about this this morning, and I realized that there's no way for me to communicate to you what I see to be the case with the act of looking itself without going back to the beginning one more time to the circumstances and the what I did at the time that the looking that I first actually did the act and what followed from that. It would be impossible for me to really convey my sense of and what I really want to convey about the act of looking without showing you the lack of any understanding of what was happening on my part at the time that it happened. So I'm going to start from the beginning. I spent most of my life, you know, for the first 10 years of my life, I lived with my grandmother, who was a Pentecostal Christian, and who taught me to read when I was 4 by using the New Testament of the King James Bible as the source, the reading source, the reading material. So I was a confused child. And the introduction to the extremely active Christianity that consists of Pentecostal churches, again, was my introduction also to the spiritual realm, to the realm of spiritual aspiration. Religion is a form of spiritual aspiration. Much of spiritual aspiration has arisen within the religious context, especially in India, which we are most familiar with now in this country. So I started out as a student, a very young student of my grandmother's Pentecostal beliefs and practices. There were times when my grandmother would have me with her at stoplights and handing out tracts concerning the Pentecostal position to drivers. So I started early. I went through, you know, that left me behind. It never left me behind, the influence of that early introduction to that kind of spiritual aspiration never entirely left me, but I left behind interest in following that or interest in religion altogether for a while. And you know, my life unfolded as it did. It's not a very ordinary life, but it unfolded as it did with all of the things that I did. I'm not going to go into all of that. You can read about that in a lot of places. Communism was a form of spiritual aspiration for me. It seemed to provide the answers that I was seeking to why things were as bad as they were and what could be done to change them, and which was at the heart of the yearning, right? The yearning that my grandmother imparted to me, a yearning for freedom, a yearning for understanding, a yearning for a way to make sense of a life that seems senseless. And of course, that particular expression of my yearning led me finally, through one means or another, to a considerable amount of time in federal prison. Not going to go into all the details of that. But while I was in prison, I was in prison for 18 and a half years by the time it was over. While I was in prison, early on, the yearning came back to me, this yearning for some freedom, some way to get free of the endless weight of being alive and being ignorant and being all that I was. And one thing led to another, and when I was in prison for a time, I actually was baptized into the Roman Catholic Church. I was quite taken with the mysticism in Roman Catholicism. It seemed like mysticism was a lot better way to go than communist revolution at the time. And I was taken with the mysticism. I was taken with the rituals and all of that. And I always had, and still do have, considerable affection and respect for Jesus, for the guy from Nazareth that caused such a furor in the short time that he was alive and teaching. That didn't last too long. I had a couple of mystical experiences in the course of my adventure in Roman Catholicism. But that didn't last too long. You know, things like that fall away pretty quickly. The religion just did not, for me, have any, it just increased the yearning. It didn't get rid of the yearning. It didn't get rid of this sense that there was something wrong, that there ought to be something to do about it. So I kind of settled in after I kind of drifted away from any kind of practice of Roman Catholicism or any other religion, and drifted into a more ordinary prison experience, for life in prison. You know, that consisted in doing the things that prisoners do, and I was able to get in a position where I had the opportunity to learn very early on to be introduced to personal computers and the great mystery of modern information technology, which has served me well and served us all, Carl and I, very well in this work, the work of bringing this idea of looking to the world. After some years, when you're in federal prison, they transfer you. You don't stay in one place more than 3 or 4 years. At that time, things are a lot different now, but at that time, you don't stay in one place very long so that you don't have the opportunity to settle in and, you know, get close to the guards or understand the system enough to escape. I'd already done my escaping a couple times and wasn't so much interested in it anymore. After a couple moves from one penitentiary to the other and then finally into a little lower security level institution in Washington, I finally ended up in a federal correctional institution in Englewood, Colorado. And it was there that I entered the search for spiritual liberation wholeheartedly and threw myself into it. And that came about because, first of all, I had the opportunity to spend some time with a group of Buddhists who were coming in from Naropa, the Trungpa Rinpoche organization, and giving, talks, teachings on the Tibetan Buddhism approach to spiritual liberation. And I was quite taken by that. It just blew me away. It seemed to me to be so much what I already knew, the Buddhist teachings. That was that particular approach to Buddhism and Buddhist aspiration, Buddhist practice. And then I had the great good fortune of meeting Gangaji, who came to the prison and just kind of blew me away. I was completely unsettled. My understanding of things, my approach to things was completely unsettled. Gangaji arrived like a typhoon into my spiritual life, which was itself at that time fledgling. As a result of running into Gangaji, and I became very close to her, we had a very close relationship for a long time. And so I had the opportunity then to be introduced to Ramana and Papaji. Ramana, at the time, I didn't think very much of, because he was telling us that we should find out who we are. And I, of course, by then already knew who I was. I was infinite, untouched, pure consciousness. No self, no mind. I knew that. So I wasn't much interested in Ramana, but Papaji I was turned on by and very excited by. Gangaji, the meeting with Gangaji and the introduction to that form of spiritual aspiration in the kind of Upanishadic traditions led me then to other ideas in the same Upanishadic vein, most of them. I read Yoga Vasistha, and I read Wei Wu Wei, and I read much about Dzogchen. And if you're unfamiliar with those terms, don't concern yourself with it. They're just books and authors. And Dzogchen is an approach to enlightenment. Finally, it didn't take too long. I mean, I was ripe, and the circumstances were entirely supportive of what happened. I attained what I believed to be, with my whole heart, liberation. I spent about a year and a half kind of floating through life. I was convinced that I was enlightened and awake and that I saw things other people could not see. After about a year and a half, that form of liberation collapsed on me. It collapsed in the way that things happened, circumstances in my life were changing, and things were happening that caused me to be more interested in earthly liberation than the liberation offered by spiritual aspiration. And in that whole experience of liberation and freedom from the the difficulties of being in a human life, that liberation just collapsed. It was horrendous. I was filled with anger, torment, self-condemnation, and every other form of stupidity in that area that can possibly be imagined. It got to the point. Now, I'm still in prison, and actually I'm in prison in a circumstance where I had almost no responsibilities. I had a job that involved doing nothing but spending a half hour every morning cleaning the bathroom in the staff lounge. They had forbidden me to be around computers. I say that just to explain why I had the time to do what I proceeded to do. I was miserable. I was torn apart. I had no hope, and I was living in pain. In desperation, I went back to Ramana again and started reading talks. I had the book called Talks with Ramana Maharshi. I started reading it again, and I started looking more seriously into what he was saying. And at one point in my investigation, I found that Ramana, unlike anybody else I'd heard of, had some ideas about things that were really, really not consistent with the orthodox Upanishadic teachings. Found out that Ramana had ideas that were inconsistent with orthodox Upanishadic and Advaita Vedanta ideas of liberation. One of which that caught my attention was his advice to a seeker who came to him to when asked about what to do about ego. Ramana told him that he should grab ego by the throat and try to choke it. And that seemed unusual, a strange thing to be told in a context that denied the existence of ego. So I thought, well, I'm going to try that. Why not? I've got nothing to lose. So I would sit on my bunk in my cell for hours at a time, seeing if I could find something that seemed to me to be recognizable to be ego, in the sense that ego is spoken of in the teachings, so that I could grab it by the throat. And I would find, internal feeling states and so forth that seemed to me to be ego-like, and I would try to pounce on them with the beam of my attention and grab them and hold them choke them by the throat and get rid of it. Didn't have much luck at that. I mean, it was interesting and it was fun, but I didn't have much luck. It didn't do much for me. Except that somehow in the course of doing that, there was a moment when in trying to do that instruction, when I had this memory of myself as a child, still living with my grandmother, and I had gone to a afternoon matinee of a movie called Winchester 73. I've spoken about it before. And sitting on my bed in the prison in Colorado, that memory of the coming out of the movie in the broad daylight in the summertime and from a dark and air-conditioned theater, just kind of spontaneously came to me, the memory of that and the feeling of it. And I noticed, curiously, that what I felt like then was exactly what I felt like now, but quickly disappeared from interest, and I went on about my business and enjoying the misery and continuing to try to do something about it. And then over time, I began to lose interest in the whole, Carla just told me that she has been losing sound from me, and if that's the case with you too, we can talk about it when we're done. There's nothing much I can do about it now. But keep in mind that if there are times when my sound seems to be going out for you, that's something that we're aware of and don't know what to do about. So in any event, as time passed and I was still waiting to get out, waiting to, you know, get out of prison and still in my normal circumstance, and my interest in the whole project began to fade. And I didn't pay much attention to it. It wasn't anything that seemed of any consequence to me. It just happened. I also noticed that from time to time I would return to that memory of myself as a child coming out of the theater for no reason at all. It would come to my mind and I'd consider it again, and the same thing was consistently the case, that when I did that, it was what I saw was exactly what it felt like to be me at the time. And again, I didn't see any particular significance to that. The first time that I noticed that something really consequential had happened, and I didn't know how it happened or why it happened, was the day that I was to be released. I had found it difficult to believe that I would ever be released. The authorities were not all that happy with me. But I have to say that there were some exceptions to that. There were some really surprisingly, some surprising judges and other people in the course of that that made things a little easier for me. But I really never expected to get out at all. You know, even though it was the case that it was my time to be released in accordance with the way the law was at that time. So anyway, there I was, and as I started to say, the person who was responsible for my release, the department head of the receiving and discharge department, came in very early and spent a lot of time trying to find something that could hold me there. Actually, a couple hours I sat in a holding cell waiting for him to satisfy himself that there was no possibility of keeping me, even though I so richly deserved to be kept locked up. And the thing about that got my attention in a way that nothing else had so far since the Winchester 73 experience. One thing got my attention is that in all that time, the 2 or 3 hours that I sat in that holding cell, I had no concern whatsoever about what was going to occur. I really had it mattered nothing to me whether they let me go or didn't let me go. I was perfectly okay just sitting there in that holding cell. And that was so not me. You know, I'm not the most patient person in the world. I am now, but I wasn't then. So that got my attention, and I could see that something had happened to me at some time, but I had no idea what it was. You know, none. It was a great mystery to me. And I could see, in retrospect, that over the preceding months, that I had been feeling okay. Everything seemed fine to me. I didn't have the yearning for liberation. I did not have the sense of life being a burden something to be escaped from or fought with or surrendered to or whatever. I was just alive and happy to be so. And that was very strange. It was the incident in being released that brought that to my attention. So I was released. He couldn't find anything to hold me, and I was released and went. And one of the conditions of my release was that I had to find work, and the Gangaji Foundation had stepped up and offered me a job so that I could have a job that would allow me to be released from prison. So I was released in Boulder and went to work for the Gangaji Foundation, moved, and you know, my whole attitude toward Gangaji and spiritual aspiration and the whole adventure of trying to find liberation was, I had no feelings about it one way or the other whatsoever. I was not, I didn't despise Gangaji or think that she was doing wrong. I didn't think that I was doing wrong and that I should be doing something. I was just there in that job, working with her and working with the people around her, and happy to be there and happy to be doing so. I moved to California when the foundation moved to California, and continued my employment there. In June of 99, Carla and I were married, and Carla also was with Gangaji for a long time, and that's where we met, and that's the circumstances in which we found each other, was in the people around Gangaji. In June of 99, we were married, and I don't know exactly how long, but a very short time after we were married, I was laid off from the Gangaji Foundation. In August, I think. And Carla, you know, Carla actually at that time was here with a green card, and she didn't have a job, and I didn't have a job, and we weren't all that freaked out about it, but we started trying to find work to do that we could that would allow us to continue our life together and, you know, do what work does, which is give you the money to eat and pay rent and so forth and so on. We tried a number of things. We for a while started a web design business that we called North Bay Webs. That didn't do much. It was a bad time for internet startups. Carla did translation work for a long time. Carla did translation work to bring in a little bit of money into us, into our life, to pay the rent and so forth. And then people started inviting me to come and talk to them. And that was a strange thing, because I really didn't feel that I had any standing to be talking to people about the Advaita Vedanta path to liberation from the misery of life. I had found that it did not live up to its promise in my own case, and something else had happened to me. But circumstances were such that there really was no way in the world that I could say, no, I'm not going to go talk to people, because when we went to talk to people, people donated money, and we had money to live on, to pay the rent, to get food in the house, and so forth. Still, I had no idea that anything had happened at all in any real way, except maybe I had just gotten tired of the hunt. When I talked to people in those days, I in the beginning, I tried to convey the teachings in the realm of Advaita Vedanta, and especially in the realm of self-inquiry in the manner of Ramana Maharshi. We called our meeting satsang, and and all the way we set up was satsang and the Advaita Vedanta and so forth and so on. As time went on and we were meeting with people and talking to people more, it became obvious to me that, first of all, I had no idea what to say to those people that would be of any use to them. I could talk about the teachings, and I had a pretty comprehensive understanding of their purpose and their intent and so forth, but I didn't want to do that because I didn't see that there was any use to that. So I would talk to people and I would tell them what had happened to me and how it happened and how it transpired and so forth. And I started trying to make it clear to people that what I was talking about was not what I really wanted to talk about, but I didn't know how to talk about what I really wanted to talk about. So I'm talking about this and encourage them to help me find a way to say what I really wanted to say. So, to make a long story short, shorter or less long, after many years of effort and trying to find a way to speak about what had happened to me, over time, the idea, the insight began to form that moment when I remembered myself as a child, that moment had been a moment that in some way that I didn't understand was the key to it all. And in the course of conversations and trying to speak about it and trying to understand what had happened, still in a context that was spiritual in nature. I mean, the people who were coming to me were spiritual aspirants. The things that they wanted to hear about was spiritual practices and so forth. And what I wanted to talk about was trying to find a way for us to figure out what actually could be done. In 2010, I think it was 2010, things started actually to come clear to me. Now, I had been talking about the looking for a while, but I didn't know what to call what it is that I was trying to convey. And I tried different ways of talking about it and so forth and so on, and finally settled on looking as the best I could do. And in 2010, it really came to me, and the insight was very clear to me that, and it was at the end of the retreat in 2010, that what had happened to me was that act of looking in the memory of myself as a child, the recognition that what it felt like then to be me was exactly the same as it felt like now to be me, but it wasn't like a logical progression, that the fact that that is so means that I am just the same as I was then. There was no understanding or internal discussion about it of that nature whatsoever. It's just that I knew that when I looked there, that did something that brought about my release from the idea that life wasn't worth living. And since then, going on 3 years now since then, everything has clarified with much greater specificity as a result of conversations with you folks and conversations with people everywhere, every place we go, every time we talk to people. So that finally now, it is plain to me, without question, that the act of looking at the actual feeling, the simple feeling of you brings an end to misery and hatred of life itself. Now, the thing that I really want to point out here, because the thing that I really want to get to here, and the reason that I have meandered like I have, is that the looking is not a big thing. The looking is not some gigantic, mysterious, magical movement that has significance in itself. There's no particular significance to the act of looking. And now people do the act of looking because it's suggested to them. But the act itself has no particular significance. All it does is destroy the context that was formed in the terror of birth. The context, which is the fear of life, and as I spoke about yesterday, that's a context. It's not a feeling. It's not a sensation. It's a context that corrupts everything that develops within it, corrupts it, and contaminates it with the assumption that there's something wrong, that I have to watch out, that I have to be very careful. But the looking itself is of no consequence. It's pleasant enough. Sometimes it has no particular effect that is noticed. It's a very small thing. It's not anything to get all excited about. So you see, the looking is not the thing. The life is the thing. The looking is done once, and it may repeat, you know, it repeated for me for some time, and I now mostly am just aware of what it feels like here. I think I always was, but didn't notice it. So the looking is not a big deal. It's nothing to make a big fuss about. It's nothing to be turned into a practice. It's nothing to be turned into anything at all. If you take a look, if you try to look at yourself, the context that has formed as the fear of life will evaporate. It's just that simple. And there's no point to making any big deal of the looking. There's no point in wondering whether you're doing the looking right. This is important. There's no point in following ideas as to whether you are or are not doing the looking right. There's no point in being feeling the need to do it more often than you do. There's no need, really, to do it more than once. That's really the case. The looking is not like a place that you can go to in order to find relief from the vicissitudes of life. It's not a place you can go to in order to find relief from the, you know, whatever it is that you need relief from. What the looking does is done in the first instant and never has to be done again. It doesn't need to be shunned, and you probably will do it again because it's not, you know, it's pretty cool. It's not anything to get hung about, but the one thing that I have seen is the one thing that I have seen that has caused people considerable confusion and anxiety is the idea that there's some special thing that has to happen that goes under the name of the looking. There's some special experience or payoff that has to come from it. There is some special way for it to be done, and there is some need to constantly return to it in order to refresh whatever came of it in the first place. All of those ideas are remnants of the psychology of fear. And they don't need to have anything done about them either. But that's all they are. The looking, done once, does the job. And that's the point I most want to make about the looking. Okay. Another thing, interestingly enough, is that the other day, there's a question of how the looking works, what it does, why it works, why it has the effect it has, and there's a person in South Africa now who is working with other people to bring the news of the looking more widespread in the context in which he operates, and is going to be meeting with him. And he sent me an email the other day that asked me, told me that he has something going on, and asked me why, if I had any idea as to why the looking it did what it does what it does, because he was meeting with people and they're interested in that. And I wrote back to him. My answer to him was this. And this is in order to show you what the most recent sense is of the effect of the looking and why it works as it does, although I don't have really much to say about it, as you'll see. I responded to him and said, that question has been with me for a long time now, without producing a satisfactory answer. My best guess is that when attention, which is the psychological organ that concentrates consciousness and directs it to objects of interest, when attention rests for a moment on the actual person, the feel of the actual person, the psychology exists to serve, the taste of reality just invalidates the entire agenda of defense and acquisition that's been running the show for so long, and it just disappears. And its departure then gives rise to a fundamental regeneration of the psychology. It's all just thought, after all. I know this is too abstract to be of much use, but it's the best I can do so far. And that's what I said to him, and the truth is that there are a lot of people who are paying a lot of attention to the act of looking and its effects and why it does what it does. There are psychologists and psychiatrists that are interested in it. And what I said to him is actually what I think does happen, although, of course, that's just it's an abstract presentation of what I think might be the case. And, the day might come and we all know why it works. But the thing about it is, the thing about that whole discussion is that it really doesn't matter. And although I have a kind of lighthearted curiosity about whether it's possible to find the actual mechanism that is triggered by the looking, I really don't care if we ever find it. What I care about is getting people to do the act. We called it the looking, finally, because nothing else seemed to fit. There's no need to elevate the looking by capitalizing it. It's just the most kind of non-specific verb. It's a gerund when we call it the looking, but a non-specific verb that fits what the actual experience of trying to do it it actually feels like. It feels like we're looking for something. You don't have to. Looking is not necessarily visual. You can look in your pockets with your hands. You can look for things in all kinds of ways other than just vision. So, I hope that's helpful. The looking is so little a thing that to focus on it as the most important thing in this work, even though the work cannot continue without it is missing the point of it. The looking, once done, becomes uninteresting and unnecessary. Nothing wrong with doing it, but unnecessary. And what becomes much more interesting and much more practically useful is the looking at the experience of your life unfolding as you. Looking at the way in which circumstances shape and form the characteristic of your life as it unfolds, and looking at the relationship between the kind of wildness of life and this person that I am, and looking at the actual capability we have of living our lives more intelligently, with more practical intelligence. It's from a sane foundation that does not start with the assumption that life is not to be trusted. And the absence, this is the most amazing thing to me, because it is so kind of quiet. It doesn't call attention to itself. But the absence of that whole sense that there is me, this personality, that there is this personality looking at life, which is something separate. In the end, the work of the looking erases all sense of any boundary whatsoever, any place where the life living itself is separate from me living here. That just vanishes. Over time, it vanishes. And it changes everything. So, point I tried to make is that the looking is not a big deal. You have to do it, but once you do it, you don't have to worry about it. You don't have to continue doing it, and you don't have to stop doing it. But what you will find, if I am correct here, what you will find is that as time passes, the sense that there's something that you really need to do, that is looking, the sense that there's something you have to continue doing in order to keep things on an even keel, that just goes away like smoke. It's nothing. It's possible to be confused when that happens. But the confusion, too, is nothing. So, I don't know if I conveyed what I wanted to convey. I'm sorry for the technical details, the technical difficulties we had. But I'm done talking now. So I'm happy to hear from any of you. Anybody wants to talk to me, raise your hand. Barbara?
Yes, hi, John. How are you today?
Hi. I'm great. You?
Good. It seems to me, from what you just said, that what the looking does is make one aware that one is not the body, one is not the personality.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
No? Okay.
No, it has nothing to do whatsoever in forming new ideas about what you are or are not. It has no effect on that whatsoever, except that the old ideas about what you are and are not will in time just vanish as the regeneration of the psychology unfolds. But it doesn't tell you anything about anything. It's like if you put your finger in water, your finger gets wet. If you look at the feeling of you, the context of fearfulness and distrust disappears. It has nothing to do with understanding.
Well, it seems to me what it does is show me that I'm me, and not my personality and not my body, but I'm me, the consciousness.
No, that's not what it does.
No? Okay.
No, it doesn't show you anything. Barbara doesn't show you anything. There are, especially with someone like myself and perhaps you, with a strong spiritual experience and understanding and so forth, it can produce thoughts about it. The fact that the fear is gone is what produces the thoughts about it. But that's all. It doesn't tell you anything. And those thoughts about it are actually useless. The thoughts about I am not the body, I am not this, I am something else entirely. Those are useless thoughts. Life is what's useful. If you're here to be alive, whether you are the body or not the body, you know, you're here alive in this body, and the body is the vehicle by the means of which you get to live your life. The brain, the heart, the taste, the sense, the senses, the whole thing, that's the mechanism whereby you can live your life. There's nothing wrong with life. There's nothing wrong with the body. We do not have the experience of life without a body. So that the ideas about the implications of what the looking does that seek to find consistency with other ideas about the nature of being a human being are just ideas that come up because the whole system gets confused by the looking. It has nothing to worry about and nothing to attend to. The thing to attend to is the way in which life is unfolding. The thing to attend to is the work on understanding and becoming good at doing what can be done as you in this life. The thing that is important, the things that are useful and worthwhile are the understanding that comes about the nature of the psychology, about the way in which thoughts arise, about what thoughts are and what they are not, and that all is just a natural part of the unfolding of life once the fear is gone. And it's all practical. It is the interest in abstract and metaphysical understandings of our nature pretty much departs. Follow me?
Okay. I have to just stop trying to figure it out.
Yeah, right, if you can. But be aware of the fact, right, that you're not the one that is causing those thoughts and understandings to arise. This is the psychology running on the autopilot. This is not your thoughts, you know. So when thoughts like that come, you can look at them, and you can look at what it is that they are talking about, the feeling that caused that thought to come up, and then you can look at your breath. You can look at all those things, and nothing whatsoever changes about you or your life. Your life unfolds as it does. Your relationship with your life unfolds as it does, but now with the possibility of being more skillful and less crazy about it. Okay?
Okay. Thank you.
Stick with us. Keep in touch.
I'm going to, believe me.
Okay. Okay. Charles?
Hi. I don't know exactly how to ask a question, but where do I start? So you've learned, you went through the teachings of Ramana, Papaji. Did you say Papaji?
Papaji, yeah.
Papaji
and a bunch of others. Nisargadatta. You know, I had a lot of free time, so.
So that's pretty much like the whole Advaita Vedanta. Is that true?
Yes, I have a good understanding of the Advaita Vedanta perspective.
What was it about it that was unfulfilling? Or my question is like, what is it not the answer in your experience, or was it Was it that it wasn't a quick, practical way of going about it, or I think you kind of know where I'm getting at.
Yes, and I have spoken about this. I think I might have spoken about this earlier in this thing. Wait, have you been here every day?
Yeah, maybe I missed it.
Maybe I didn't then. I recently did a talk on the question, is this spiritual, in a worldwide meeting, but let me tell you now. Here's what I think, okay? I think that everybody who was authentic, I'm going to try to be brief with this. I think that everybody who authentically has lost the burden of the fear, and that includes Ramana and Papaji and Nisargadatta and a whole bunch of other people going back for the 5,000 years that this particular approach has been present. That what happened is this. People who are desperately seeking, you know, not everybody in the world, most people, the most common strategy for dealing with the dissatisfaction with life is denial. So most of us don't get caught up in a real intense personal war, a struggle to find liberation from anything in the spiritual realm. But among those who do, and it's just the way that the psychology is in the individual people, but those who do, they are really serious about it, like me. They are really energetic and determined. They are extremely cognizant of how miserable life is in the way that it is now, and they are determined to find something to do that will free them from that. And all of these teachings actually originate in religious ideas. They all do. They from the very beginning. So there is this religious context, the context of metaphysical, that misery is a metaphysical condition and not just simply something having to do with an event in human life, that it's in a metaphysical condition, that ignorance itself is metaphysical in its nature, and that liberation is metaphysical in its nature. And that's the unexamined assumption that they bring with them to the extremely energetic effort to find a solution. Now, I think that in those cases, some of those folks, and the ones I mentioned and many others are among them, have actually stumbled upon, had their attention kind of pass across and get notice of the actual feeling of their personness, the me of them. But they didn't know that. You know, it's not a big deal. They didn't know that. So that when things started clearing up for them, when the results of that act began to show up, they ascribe it, because they have no vernacular and no concepts outside of the spiritual and religious vernacular and context, they began trying to describe it to us in that kind of an approach. And you'll see if you pay attention that much of what they tell us is how it should feel to be free of the burden of human misery. And, you know, the whole rubric of self-inquiry has tried to be a more practical approach to it, but still is occluded by the being shot through with an assumption that there's some spiritual, metaphysical thing that's happening here. What I'm saying is that those folks who have done that are authentic when they come to us and tell us that they are free from that, and that they have something to tell us that will make us free from it too. First of all, they authentically are free. And secondly, they authentically believe that that's what needs to happen. That they have to somehow get us to understand and wipe out our ignorance of the true nature of things, that nature being a metaphysical matter. And that, there we go. Then we're off and running into the entire history of the Upanishadic and Advaita Vedanta, and non-dual teachings elsewhere also. It's not only in the Upanishadic realm that there's non-dual teachings, they're elsewhere also. So, what I think is that those folks, and Ramana is a really good example of that, and I'm not going to go into the details of why you have to have an understanding of Ramana's life as a child and what happened to him in the experience that, and what happened to him following it, to follow what I'm saying. But just, you know, you can look into it and take my word for it. Ramana is a really good example of that. And Ramana is one who I think almost knew that. I think Ramana pretty much understood that whatever it was that happened to him, he could not find a way to communicate it to us. So, that said, that whole realm of spiritual and religious aspiration, yearning for, release from the burden, the feeling of being burdened as a human being, is well-intended, authentically interested in actually bringing help to the masses of people who suffer from the condition of being human, but it just has done no good to us, none whatsoever. I had great experiences, and they gave me nothing whatsoever, except finally to move me away from that. But the thing is that, and this is something that really I really wish there was a way that I could get this across clearly. The looking, no matter how it seems, has nothing to do whatsoever with what's advised in the Advaita Vedanta realm. The looking is entirely a practical human act that involves the movement of attention and does not involve anything metaphysical, spiritual, or of any kind. And the confusion that comes when people come to the looking from a spiritual background is great, and it's unfortunate. But I tell you this too, it goes away. You follow that?
Yeah.
In other words, I'm not saying, I'm trying to get this one point clear. I'm not saying there's nothing of value in the spiritual teachings. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying there is any value to them, but I'm not saying there's not any value to them either. What I'm saying is that in the matter of the human experience of having life as a burden, they are useless to us. And that what is needed is something far more practical. And it turns out, against all expectations, that this simple act of ordinary movement of the concentrated consciousness, trying to find what it feels like to be me, against all expectations, turns out that that's an entirely practical and effective thing that actually does the job. So I just don't, you know, I'm not trying to dispute the teachings, and I'm not trying to, you know, like pull them apart and explain why they're wrong and so forth and so on. Because I don't think of them in that way. I think of them as being one of the greatest and most and closest attempts that we have made as human beings to find the truth of the matter. But other equally close attempts have failed also. And that attempt has actually failed. It's failed to produce the possibility of every single human being finding freedom from the idea that life is a burden. It at best is for the very few who are sufficiently motivated to take it on. Okay? Charles, is that okay?
Hi, I'm here. No, that was great. I just, you know, I asked because I come from a lot of, I certainly studied different teachings, many different teachings, and, you know, some of them were really good, and at the same time, all of them were really unfulfilling, so,
there you go.
I kind of got tired of them.
Yeah, right. Well, good. Then you're in the right place.
So, yeah.
You know, and like we wouldn't, you know, it's interesting because there are other human activities that are also quite beautiful. And, you know, what comes to mind is music and art and stuff like that. But we don't ever think, like, nobody ever comes to this and says, oh, this is just like music or just like art, or that's what music does, or that's what art does, or that's what movies are, or anything of the kind. And what I would like is if we get to the point, which might never happen until everybody's sane, but that we get to the point where the whole body of metaphysical aspiration is seen to be irrelevant to what we're doing. Not that people have to see it to be irrelevant entirely, but that it's irrelevant to what we're doing, so we don't have to spend a lot of time talking about the differences. That's my hope.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, anybody else? Oh yeah, there is somebody who was here yesterday and couldn't speak because he didn't have a microphone, so I thought I would read to you email that he sent us concerning yesterday's conversation about the fear of life, so that he has his point of view has opportunity to be heard. Hi, John. He says, unfortunately, I don't have the microphone today, so I cannot talk, but only listen. I couldn't find a way to send text, so I'm using the email. I just wanted to report that what you have said about the fear is so true. I'm finding this out more and more. In my case, I can sometimes sense the old fear, but I think that's a good sign for it to come up and show its face. Yes, it is. That's right. Usually it's hidden. Usually nobody notices it. It's projected on to circumstance and thoughts and ideas about my worthlessness and so forth. It does come up and show its face. Also, I see more and more that life does come rushing in, and that probably accentuates the situation. Sometimes I find it odd and funny that so many spiritual communities and religious communities focus so much on all that other nonsense about what they think works, their methods, etc., etc. It's amazing. I am using the practice of focusing on the feeling bit, and then the breath. And it does help in this, especially when I cannot focus on thoughts so much. And of course, this practice, and I'm going to repeat it one more time here, this practice in which, first of all, as I have said, the looking brings about a complete regeneration of the psychology. And in the course of that regeneration, you know, the old stupidities and the old habits of relationship and so forth, they don't just magically disappear. That's what we all want when we go into the realm of spiritual aspiration. We want magic. We want something that will make everything go away right now. But that doesn't happen. And there can be, and there has been, and just as an aside, again, this work is in a constant state of development. It's not finished. It changes every time I speak to people. It's in a constant state of development and unfolding. It's not a doctrine. But what I was saying was that people can be quite disturbed and distressed about the craziness gets even crazier in the aftermath of the destruction of that context. And people can get distressed and really confused and so forth. And the truth is that, like me, things will work out on their own. There's nothing really that needs to be done about it, except that it's kind of, except that it's painful. And there's no need to go through that. And what we've discovered is this, and this is something that will be good for you for the entire life. What we've discovered is this. First of all, you must see that when we have a bad feeling about ideas present in our mind, what we are focusing on is the thoughts that are negative and that tell us that we're feeling despondent or frustrated or angry or whatever. They have a running commentary about what's happening. But those thoughts are a commentary on what's happening, and what's happening is always a sensation. Now, sensation has an extremely wide range of quality and intensity and so forth and so on. It's got a lot of, you got an itch, that's a sensation. You got a pain in your toe, that's a sensation. You get breathless, that's a sensation. There's sensations that sometimes called feeling states, but there are sensations. There's the feeling that I recognize to be impatience. There's the feeling that I recognize to be confusion, and or depression, or all those things. There are feeling states. So every thought is a thought about a sensation, and that's just a fact. Okay, we have sensations. The sensations give rise to thoughts about the sensation. We watch those sensations and thoughts about them, and we pay far more attention to the thought. We pay attention to the thought about sensation, what it is, what it means about me, what it means about you, and on and on and on. And never pay much attention at all to the actual sensation that all that fuss is being made about. So here's what we found. Moving along in your life, and all of a sudden you just feel kind of down. Things don't feel right, and I'm kind of dull and whatever. And then there's this, the way you know that is by the thoughts. There's a thought that says, oh boy, I feel shitty. I wish I wasn't here. I wish things were different than they are, and yada, yada, yada. Well, that thought holds our attention most of the time. And that's what we relate to as being the problem. But the thought is nothing. The thought is just a thought. So what we've discovered is that if you will just, and you can't always notice it, right? Really. Don't feel like this is something that you are always going to be able to do this. You can only do it when you notice that you are fixing your attention on thoughts about something that's not unpleasant here. When you notice that that's happening, just look at the thought and then look for the sensation that the thought is about, and then immediately move your attention to the breathing, to the breath, to the way it feels like. It feels to be breathing in and out. And then do whatever you want after that. What this does, and this is being confirmed by more and more people what this practice does is it doesn't clear anything up, and it doesn't produce some magic release from the presence of these sensations and thoughts. What it does is it strengthens your ability and your skillfulness at deciding for yourself what you're going to attend to, whether you're going to attend to the thought or the sensation or something more physical or something else entirely. The more skill you have at recognizing what's happening and being able to decide for yourself what you're going to attend to, the easier it will be for you to live your life in a way that is fulfilling and satisfying and skillfully managed. So that's it. That's what he's talking about, focusing on the feeling better than the breath. And that's the only practice we recommend here, and there's nothing whatsoever metaphysical or spiritual or religious about it. It's entirely a matter of practical movement of your practical ability to move your attention, which itself is quite mysterious, but doesn't matter because you can do it. Okay? Anything? Okay. I'm really grateful for, you know, you have no idea. Your presence and the ability to hear from you and to speak with you is the heart and soul of moving this work forward. There is no special understanding here. There's no special power here. There's nothing of the kind except ordinary human intelligence and now sanity. And the way in which our understanding of this and my ability to communicate it and our ability as an organization to bring it to the world is served only by constant communication and contact and conversation with you guys. Those of you who are here and those of you who are not here. By the people who are interested in this work and interested in being a part of it. So thank you so much for being here. I'll see you tomorrow. Carla?
You just listened to meeting number 3 of a 5-day online intensive with John Sherman, broadcast live from Ojai, California on June 26, 2013. For more live recordings, visit our website at www.justonelook.org.